This is the 2020-2021 Child Health and Advocacy Experience podcast. This is a four-part educational series produced by pediatric residents for pediatric residents. The focus of this series is on race, racism, and health equity. The topic for today is health disparities with asthma.
Hi, my name is Gina Jung, and this is my story.
Hi, I'm Alex Young.
And I'm Lewis Peterson, and we are all pediatric residents.
And I have a story to tell Alex, Lewis, and our listeners.
Okay, Gina, we're ready.
So, I have a patient, I'll call him Mason, and he is a 4-year-old black male with asthma. He was hospitalized for the first time a year ago, and it was pretty bad. He was admitted to the ICU on BiPAP and IV steroids. He left with an albuterol inhaler and a controller steroid inhaler, and we were hoping that that was all he'd need. Since then, he's been admitted 3 times, so often that it feels like all the residents know him.
Yeah, I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, so now he classifies as having severe persistent asthma, and he has a high-dose controller steroid inhaler and multiple medications for his allergies, too.
Wow.
Yeah, most of Mason's doctors think that his main problem is non-compliance. The wards teams and his pulmonology team are always asking his mom if she actually gives him his medicines and actually follows the asthma action plan. His pulmonologist even calls the pharmacy to make sure that his inhalers actually get filled.
Do you think that's really what's going on? Non-compliance?
Well, during his last hospitalization, his pulmonologist told me that she quizzed him and his mom, and he was refusing to use his inhalers. So eventually, after he was discharged, you know, his mom was really upset, and she came to the clinic to see me a couple days later.
What'd she say?
So she said, he refuses his inhaler 1 time, when at home he always does it right, and then the pulmonologist assumes he's been doing it wrong the whole time. She said it was so upsetting that people were assuming she was doing things wrong and not taking care of him well. She said she was upset because she was trying so hard, but he's still so sick. And she felt like a bad mom.
Yeah, I feel like this conversation about race is something that has been coming up so much lately. And just this question of whether the mom is being treated differently because of her race and because of the race of her child and what they look like. And I remember in medical school, so much of the way we were taught about all of these diseases and different conditions, race was always a part of the discussion. Which ethnicities will do worse with this particular prognosis or with this disease, or which people get it more often? And I never questioned it because you're in med school and you're just absorbing all of the information like a sponge. But now looking back, especially this year, I feel like I have to go through everything with a fine-tooth comb and make sure the way race was included in my education, in my brain, in my understanding of medicine really makes sense and isn't just racism at play in how we practice medicine and how I was taught and how they were taught before me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't help but think that there's more to it, you know, like and how race affects asthma specifically. And maybe we were taught all those things in med school and even a little bit in residency, but we shouldn't accept them at face value. Maybe we just need to dig a little deeper and find out why that health disparity exists, and then maybe we can do something about it.
My name is Greg Rodden. I'm a second-year resident at Dell Children's, and...
And my name is Anusha Chintaparthi. I'm a third-year resident at Dell Children's.
And we are lucky to be here with a fantastic, fantastic Dr. Elizabeth Matsui. Would you mind introducing yourself?
I'm happy to. So I'll give just sort of a little bit of a snippet. So I'm a pediatric allergist immunologist. And while I was doing my fellowship in allergy immunology, I got a master's of health science in epidemiology. And so I see patients about 10% of my time and have some administrative roles in the medical school. And then another good chunk of my time, I am rebuilding a research program focused on environmental health and asthma disparities.
Wonderful, wonderful. So To start out, how did you end up getting interested in like researching health disparities and the relationships between like social determinants of health, race, and asthma?
So I backed into it from a very naive and ignorant place. And so a long time ago, after I finished my residency, well, I was very interested in critical care and peds hem-onc when I was a resident and loved sort of intensive inpatient medicine and then thought I wanted to do a peds hem-onc fellowship and for a long story decided, no, that I didn't want to do it. So I spent some time working as a general pediatrician and became interested in asthma at that point in time. And around that time, there was a paper published in the New England Journal reporting on an association between cockroach allergen exposure and asthma morbidity. And so I became interested in this concept of exposures. And so I pursued a fellowship, but I didn't come at it at all from a kind of explicit or direct disparities or social determinants point of view. So this was in the early 2000s when I did my fellowship. And what unfolded over time was that, you know, we recognized that mouse infestation and mouse allergen exposure was this major driver of asthma morbidity in Baltimore. And the kids in Baltimore who were going to the ER were predominantly African American. And it became clear sort of over time, you start asking yourself, well, why is there so much mouse infestation? And then I started to understand that my friends who were living in Baltimore City, even in renovated homes, had mouse infestation. And then that starts to really beg the question about that particular kind of environment being related to, you know, historical racism and housing discrimination. And so ultimately, those questions that I started asking sort of landed me in a place of sort of asking, well, why is it that mouse infestation is such a problem in certain neighborhoods? And then I started to learn about the history of housing discrimination.
So what did you end up finding? Like, based on your research, like, what did you end up finding about how housing impacts asthma outcomes and then how that ties in with socioeconomic status and all
right.
that?
Right. So I think, you know, when I entered this area of research, there was a general understanding that housing and housing-related factors were associated with a greater burden of asthma morbidity. I think what was lacking was two things, and they're related. One is sort of the historical understanding of why unhealthy housing was concentrated in neighborhoods that were predominantly of people of color who resided there. So that historical context, I think, for many people, particularly in medical research, was completely unknown. And related to that is there's a distinction that maybe seems nuanced but is really important between studying minority health and studying health disparities. And so even though I think a lot about disparities, most of my work has been focused on within this population that's predominantly African American, what are the major causes of asthma morbidity? To answer a question about disparities, you would have to do a study that compared either racial or ethnic groups, you know, and their exposures to kind of understand. Now, it's sort of implicit that if you look at a map of, and I picked Baltimore because I moved from there a few years ago. But if you look at a map of Baltimore, the areas with the highest burden of asthma are the same areas that were redlined. And those are the same areas that have the most sort of dilapidated and unhealthy housing. And so when you kind of connect all of that evidence, even though it's not explicit and direct about disparities, it kind of points in that direction.
Okay. The term redline, could you define that for those who are listening?
Yes. So redlining comes from maps that were developed in the 1930s that were color-coded based on an assessment of the risk of lending money for to purchase houses or mortgages to people living in that area. And it was largely based on the racial and ethnic composition of those neighborhoods. And so those neighborhoods that were considered high lending risks had red lines drawn around them. And those neighborhoods, the redlining was initially done by the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which was a private entity that was kind of an umbrella entity over banks that were mortgage lenders. But that system was adopted by the federal government and by the Federal Government Housing Administration. And so this racist policy became not just something which is problematic in the private sector, but it became embedded in federal government policy.
Going off of that, I saw a lecture you did recently when you talked about that occurring in Austin back in the 1920s, where they zoned certain areas. And I think of East Austin, which the industrial rules were also very lax, and they had increased air population in those areas. So, you know, I'm curious how much of this is in a policy level, which as pediatricians, what can we do to advocate for, like, the zoning rules and industrial air pollution that's affecting certain areas that were historically redlined in this way?
Right. I think the first step is awareness. The second step is, the second point I would make is that there are lots of advocacy opportunities for pediatricians on multiple levels, and you can get involved in local organizations. As one example, there's an environmental health interest group that the medical students have formed, and the Environmental Health Center that I direct, we've sort of facilitated their writing op-eds. We provide scientific oversight. They're very focused on climate change, but there's a lot of need for kind of advocacy work, and there are many channels to do that. There are also implications for the individual patient sitting in front of you. And so if we go back to that example of mouse infestation, if I would see a patient in my clinic who said, yes, I've been having problems with mouse infestation, I'd provide some education, which should be done and is the minimum that needs to be done. But it is woefully insufficient because what I know is that, colleagues of mine who lived in gentrified blocks not far from there and had all the means to address mouse infestation couldn't even do this. So it's easy to sort of lay blame and personal responsibility, at the foot of the parent or the family. When you don't recognize that there are all sorts of structural forces. And so there are ways in those circumstances, there are housing advocacy organizations. We had identified reputable pest management companies that would offer discounts. We had a medical legal partnership. So we, I had a lawyer who did pro bono work where I could refer families to help advocate for either landlords to, address an issue or for them to get support navigating like their long lists, wait lists, but to move to a better housing. So I would write letters if for patients who were struggling with asthma, who also were struggling with home, poor environmental conditions in their home that were contributing. There's another sort of housing movement that has been around for a while called housing mobility. And that's another way that a family can be supported if they're eligible for a federal housing voucher to move from, say, a high poverty neighborhood to an opportunity neighborhood where the housing conditions are better. There is one of those in Baltimore. I don't believe there's a housing mobility program here, but the Austin Tenants Council is a great housing advocacy organization that patients can be referred to. So there are things that you can, first of all, is being educated and being aware. Second of all, finding avenues for advocacy. But then there are things you can do for individual patients and understanding that, particularly for someone my generation, there's so much emphasis on individual responsibility, but understanding and recognizing that there are all sorts of forces that may not be overt or easily seen that limit someone's ability to control their home environment.
Circling the topic back a little bit, one of the, myths that we're trying to address with this podcast is like narratives of like race-based medicine and and like particularly the idea that like there's some like intrinsic characteristic of African-American children that drives them to have worse, particularly pediatric asthma outcomes. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Yes. And I think that that view is sort of born out of, you know, the history of this country and how we're acculturated and then our, you know, sort of immediate position of looking at people and taking their physical appearance and then making leaps about, you know, what does that mean? And so if you, you know, work in an emergency room and the majority of kids who come in are African American, you know, for asthma exacerbations, then all of hundreds of years of history and acculturation is brought to bear when you make those observations. And so then you cognitively make this assumption that there must be something inherent to people with darker skin that must explain, you know, why they're in the emergency room so much. And what's amazing is our cognitive biases fight really hard to try to hold on to that. And some examples that I will give are, so even though, as I mentioned, you know, in the 1990s, there was an awareness that housing was an issue, you still to this day can evaluate the literature, and there's still a massive literature that's been desperately hunting for a genetic explanation for asthma disparities. And there's really very little evidence, if any at all, that genetics explains more severe asthma among African Americans. But it's very difficult for humans to disabuse themselves of that notion. And some other examples are, I'll give a concrete example of, there was a paper published pretty recently, and this was a group that had a study population, and they noticed that kids who were Black were like twice as likely to go to the emergency room for asthma. I mean, similar to what's been reported over and over. And so they tried to explain away the difference to see if they could make the difference between Black and white kids in terms of their risk of going to the emergency room, if it went away, if they adjusted for socioeconomic factors. So this was a group that was thinking like, well, this is not inherent to race. This is really inherent to all the experiences that come with race. And so they adjusted for, you know, the income of households in the zip code and a couple of other crude measures. And it reduced the difference between Black and white kids by about 40%, which is a huge amount. But there was still this greater risk going to the ED associated with Black race. But there were all these things they didn't account for, like individual level income, material hardship, psychosocial stress, healthcare access, quality of care that you get, insurance status, you know, it can go on and on. But the wording in the paper used the term Black phenotype of asthma. And so this was a paper that was published sometime in the last 5 years. This is not, and I think what's really critical here is this is a really smart group of very well-respected physicians and asthma researchers. Yet this was sort of the fallback position. And, you know, I know this group of people, or many of them, this is not a conscious sort of conclusion that they drew, but it tells you how powerful our confirmation bias is, and how hard it is to sort of, you know, fight against that as a default position. But really there's very little, if any, evidence that there's anything, you know, genetic that explains disproportionate asthma morbidity among African Americans or other populations.
Yeah, so I'm guessing that like kind of all of those examples that you listed out that were unaccounted for by the study have been looked at by other researchers and found as like independent risk factors for
in a whole variety of settings, but it's like one study here, another study there, because in the end, it's almost impossible to account for all of those things, because you can never have enough funding or resources to measure everything about the Black family's experience in the U.S. Or I think another overlooked group, which is really relevant here in Texas, is that did you know that Mexican-American kids with asthma have the same excess asthma morbidity compared to whites as Blacks have compared to whites, Black kids? And I think that's not been well accepted. And so there's a whole nother, you know, we talk about sort of disparities in asthma, and I think our default is to think about Black kids in America. And it's really an important disparity because it has persisted and but there are other racial and ethnic groups that also experience disparities that are quite substantial, that are informed by social determinants of health, but with a different kind of historical background.
I think there was a paper I read this week that one of my colleagues shared, the PM2.5 polluters disproportionately. Mm-hmm. And that one, it showed people of color, Blacks, Hispanics, and Asians all had like exposure to air pollutions, no matter urban or non-urban environments, incomes. So there's so much more to it than what we initially think about.
Absolutely. And I think going back to your statement about when Austin, there was redlining in Austin, but in Austin there was also the city plan that was enacted in 1928, and Central East Austin became the African American neighborhood because it was the only area where African Americans could access public services, schools, et cetera. But along with that, zoning laws were put in place where predominantly white neighborhoods had stricter zoning against, you know, certain types of industry that are pollution sources. And East Austin had very little regulation. And that's why when you look at the landscape of East Austin, it looks different. And industry tends to be, you know, important sources of air pollution. And so I know you're going to be doing a neonatology fellowship where we are starting to understand that air pollution affects, you know, risk of preterm birth, and it affects birth weight. And, you know, not so long ago, you know, well, depending on your lens, but, you know, back when I was a resident rotating through the NICU, if I looked at a, you know, baby there, I wouldn't have thought about, you know, the environment and how that may have played a role in that baby landing in the NICU.
What do you think our role is as like health professionals when we address these biases that we might have, and how can we, well, what do you think our role is in mitigating the negative outcomes from all of these kind of biases?
Yeah, well, and I think it goes back to there's the first step is kind of awareness and understanding that a patient in front of you comes with context and actually a whole lot of history behind, you know, whatever the chief complaint is. I mean, I think we've grown over decades to understand that that's the case, not just for asthma, but for kind of, you know, anybody who, you know, whether they're there for like a well child check or some sort of health complaint. But understanding that the historical context and then the environmental context and the history of structural racism and how the patient in front of you, you know, may have missed half a day of work in order to bring their child to the visit and, you know, is in danger of losing their job over that or so on and so forth. So I think having an appreciation of that, it actually goes a really long way. But the next steps are trying to develop a catalog of resources that can address any social needs that you might encounter. And identifying those social needs, I think, is actually can be very challenging and hard because you have to have time to ask about them. You have to, the patient has to trust you. And or you have to have a sort of support in your clinical arena where maybe there is someone, whether it's a social worker or it doesn't have to be that, the medical assistant who checks the patient in, where there is sort of a relationship that's grounded in trust, and so that you can then sort of connect families with social services and other support. And then I think that, you know, I'm in a world where advocacy work is important. I'm very involved in the American Academy of Pediatrics section on allergy and immunology. And that's, I think, that and other sort of professional societies or nonprofits are great ways to use your expertise, and really physicians are incredibly well regarded. So you're speaking from a place of respect and authority to do some advocacy work. But I also want to acknowledge that not everybody feels comfortable with that, really. And not everybody feels like when they signed on, to be a physician, that what comes with that is advocacy work. But I think at the least what comes with that is taking the best care of your patients that you can. And I think we talked about, ways that you can think about how to make that happen, given, understanding that, the patient has a ton of history and context that comes with them, that may be the reason why they're there in front of you.
Yeah, I think that's a fabulous framework with which to approach it. And something that I think a lot of people connect very well to is like individual stories. Do you have any individual stories or like good anecdotes of ways that you handled this well when sitting across from a patient and a parent?
Oh, gosh. I would love to say that, I have all the answers in that regard. There's one, boy that I remembered, but it was a very frustrating story, which is that he had terrible asthma. It's really unusual, as you know, for kids to not be able to get off of oral steroids. This was before we had biologics. And he had terrible eczema and multiple food allergies and had terrible housing conditions. And I connected the family with legal support, and they qualified for public housing. But the wait list to move into public housing was years long. And so I think the message there is that there is a lot we can do. Like, she would never even applied for, new housing. And eventually a year later, he got into new housing. But the structural and systemic forces are incredibly strong. And so ultimately, to sort of address some of these issues, we need housing for everybody, for example, and there's only so much you can do. But I was glad that there was the legal resource that I could connect he and his mother and, the rest of his family to. And I think that was a help to them in the end, but it wasn't kind of, this silver bullet, like, oh, you just connect them with resources and everything's kind of solved. But I'm also very acutely aware of, we had a focus group that we observed, but we were, behind a one-way mirror. And this was parents of kids with uncontrolled asthma. And all the parents were either Latinx or African American. And there were clearly things that they would never say in a visit with me. I'm, a white, well-off, doctor. And there are things that, I told this to a friend of mine who was visiting. And he said, of course they didn't tell you. I mean, do you tell the dentist that you floss every night? So, you know, to me, it's just the awareness of that. And there are some things like I take a history about pests, and oftentimes I'll say, you know, pretty much everyone in Baltimore sees mice. So, you know, tell me if you had any. So I preface it by kind of normalizing the experience. When I talk about medication adherence, I often preface it by saying, oh, this is the hardest part. I have the easy job of writing the prescription. You have the hardest part of taking the medication, and you're trying to get kids out the door to school, and I know it's chaotic, so let's think through, like, you know, where the challenges are and put a plan together. So that, I think, can be helpful, but in the end, I'm a scientist, so I have no idea, because I don't have a comparator condition, if that makes sense.
When we were talking about personal stories, some of our colleagues also talked about certain patient that they would see frequently with severe asthma, and how a lot of the specialists and the providers in the hospital assumed that there was non-compliance, no matter what the family would tell the caregivers. And I feel like I've caught myself, too, automatically thinking or getting frustrated with the family and assuming there's non-compliance, because that's easier to do than think about all of the factors affecting their health. How do you think that our education system could be improved so that we kind of incorporate that thought process of thinking about health disparities? Because right now I feel like I did not receive that kind of, you know, background when I was training.
Yes. You know, I don't run the medical education curriculum, you know, in this country, but...
Let's say you did.
Let's say I did. You're going to give me all the power? I don't know whether you want to do that or not. Acknowledging that it's incredibly tough to get into, all 4 years of medical school, you know, everyone's arguing, I don't sit at the table either, about what the priorities are. I think there are plenty of opportunities to do it. And I can give you at least one example kind of in a research curriculum example, and it, you know, maybe it might provide some sort of framework for thinking about it in terms of medical education. So, we have sort of like a mini biostatistics epi research methods course called Ideas to Results that we have in the medical school. This year, all of the faculty who were giving lectures got together, and we talked about how every single one of the lectures, like how do you frame your research question? How do you identify the population? How do you recruit them? What are you measuring? Are you using spirometry, and are you doing race adjustment? And what does that mean? That at every step of the way of thinking about how to conceive of and execute a research project, there's an intersection with health disparities and racism and discrimination. And so every single lecture, it gets woven into that. And so, you know, you could think about your clinical experience when you present cases. You know, for every single case, there's an example of thinking about, well, what does it mean, you know, when this patient presents to you and has diabetes or obesity or asthma or, you know, a whole variety of issues, and what are all the contextual factors, and what are the contextual factors that may have, emanated from the history of structural racism. And I think there's the same way that you can, you know, in the didactic courses that you take. And then, of course, I know that there are electives. For example, there's an environmental health elective, and there's a lot of, you know, intersection between environmental health and environmental justice and health disparities.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, as we're kind of like wrapping up here, what would you say is like the one pearl of wisdom that you would want the audience to walk away with?
That I think Anisha said it very well, which is that there's a real, it's not even just a temptation, it's our instinct that when things aren't working well for a patient, at least what we have imagined our treatment recommendations are not working well. There is sort of this overwhelming force that defaults to it's got to be something wrong with the patient and not with the healthcare system or the treatment, you know, that's been prescribed, et cetera. And I think it's hard to resist that, but I think resisting that and taking a step back can be a very helpful sort of stance when trying to take care of, you know, individual patients that have a whole different set of struggles and contextual issues than, you know, I might have if I, you know, went to the doctor. And I think that's true not just with, well, why can't you get rid of cockroaches? You know, your mind has these thoughts. Well, why can't you get rid of the mice? I, you know, showed you how to use mouse traps. Or I don't understand why you can't take your medicine every day. I think another thought that is one to try to fight is when it's not clear what's going on, and often the default is, well, this is a, you know, psychiatric condition, and there's nothing real there. And you know, certainly sometimes, you know, anxiety disorder or whatever can present with vocal cord dysfunction, and there is something going on there. But I think people, it's easy to have a too low of a threshold for sort of pushing off those kind of responsibilities on, you know, either onto the individual patient or some other problem that's not your problem. And also, to be fair, on the other hand, it's like really hard to practice medicine in our U.S. healthcare system. So you also, in a sense, you know, can do your best, but you have to give yourself a break because you can't be all things to all people at all times, but you can give it your best shot.
All right. Well, Dr. Matsui, thank you so very much for joining us and for sharing all the wisdom that you have to share.
Oh, it was a great fun to meet both of you and to get a chance to talk about this.
We'd like to thank Dr. Matsui for her time and expertise in showing us that racism rather than race is the risk factor. For more tools and resources, so you too can feel empowered to help combat personal and systemic bias and racism in medicine, see the links in the description. Thanks for listening.